Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Delaware Department of Justice Human Trafficking Unit is 3 years old and working to find more ways to address the issue locally.
If we are able to target the demand for sex, our hope is that we can also target that demand for human trafficking.
We sat down with a member of the unit to discuss the state's efforts to crack down on human trafficking. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also learned about local research to help make petting and soccer safer. In Arts Playlist, we meet a local business professor making a splash in the film industry. And History Matters delves into the paths to freedom for enslaved people during the American Revolution. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. January was National Human Trafficking Awareness Month. It also marked 3 years since the Delaware Department of Justice created a unit specifically devoted to prosecuting human traffickers and shutting down businesses involved in this illegal act. As defined by the National Human Trafficking Hotline, human trafficking is when perpetrators use force, fraud, or coercion to control victims for the purpose of engaging in commercial sex acts or labor services against the victim's will. Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich sat down with Deputy Attorney General Caroline Brittingham, who has worked on the human trafficking unit since its inception in 2022, to discuss how the First State is cracking down on this crime.
So the human trafficking unit was created in 2022, and you've been there since its inception. Why did the Department of Justice feel like this specific unit was necessary in the First State? Has the state been seeing an uptick in human trafficking in recent years, or can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. So Kathy Jennings created the unit, as I said, in January of 2022, and it's really just a spot, a central location to be able to address human trafficking. So before, if a human trafficking referral or a human trafficking investigation came to the Department of Justice, it would go to a prosecutor, but it could be a prosecutor in the felony trial unit, it could be a prosecutor in the sex crimes unit or special victims unit. But creating this unit was a way to have a central location for any information that comes in about human trafficking.
Got it. And so DOJ just announced closing its 25th illicit massage establishment. Can you explain what these establishments are and how DOJ works to close them down?
Sure. So this is something that our office has worked on for years. Even back when I was a prosecutor in the drug unit, we were focused on illicit massage establishments. So it's not a new thing, but now that we have this centralized unit, it allows us to kind of put a greater focus on the illicit massage establishment industry. We receive information on illicit massage establishments from law enforcement, from citizens. We also track online review boards where there are reviews left for illicit massage establishments. So they kind of come on our radar multiple different ways. But since the unit's inception, we've really tried to put more of a focus on reducing the number statewide. So yes, we had the press release about the 25th closure, which is great. We're really trying to get greater awareness out there. I always explain it to people, you know, we know where they are if we're looking. So we're a small state. There was one next to my post office, you know. There may be one next to your favorite sandwich shop. It may be something that you pass and you wonder what is going on behind those doors. A lot of times they have window coverings that cover everything. You can't see through the windows. You can't see through the doors. They usually don't have posted hours. Usually the clientele is all male and it's usually 20 to 30 minute time slots. So just kind of some red flags that if people are paying attention, they will notice. So we're just trying to get a greater awareness out there. We've worked with police on doing search warrants at some of these establishments. We've worked with regulatory agencies like the Division of Professional Regulation to shut them down through them. And we've also worked with landlords, just trying to give them the tips and the tools and the awareness to know who they are renting to.
And I don't know if you have this information, but comparatively, like you said, Delaware is a small state and, you know, closing 25 of these establishments. Do you know, like, roughly for states around the same size, is that maybe a normal number? Is that higher than usual? Or how do you feel like Delaware is comparing with other neighboring states?
Sure. So just 2 weeks ago, I attended a conference in Arlington that was focused solely on illicit massage establishments. So I was able to really collaborate with other prosecutors and other agencies from other states. And Delaware is doing a great job on decreasing these numbers. These businesses are growing across the nation. There are more and more of them every year. But we have to constantly keep working at decreasing the number. And because our unit has been decreasing that number, I would say Delaware is doing a really great job. We were able to kind of look at stat sheets for Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, and we've had a significant decrease over the past few years. So I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to do in the illicit massage industry.
Great. Yeah. And DOJ and other assisting agencies have also charged a total of 29 sex buyers in a statewide campaign to address human trafficking. The Human Trafficking Unit and its partners have also conducted reverse prostitution operations across the state. Can you tell me a bit more about this time frame, like when these, the 29 sex buyers were charged, and then what it takes to conduct reverse prostitution operations? Just tell me more about that.
So this is kind of another initiative that we've been focusing on within our unit, is working with local law enforcement on doing these reverse prostitution operations. We've really ramped it up within the past year. A lot of those arrests, that were publicized were within the last year, but there were some that were the years prior as well. But within the last year, we've worked specifically with Delaware State Police, Georgetown Police Department, and Dover Police Department to conduct these operations. So it usually entails having an undercover officer that is solicited or patronized for a sexual act, and then an arrest is made. It is a misdemeanor here in Delaware, and that is, pretty similar to all other states. I think it's only a felony in Texas. It is a misdemeanor, but it's still something that we're focused on because if we are able to target the demand for sex, our hope is that we can also target that demand for human trafficking. So if we're able to drive down the numbers of people who are patronizing prostitutes, we're also hopeful that we can drive down the demand for human trafficking.
Great. That segues right into, has there been any legislation passed in recent years that have really bolstered efforts to crack down on human trafficking in Delaware, anything specifically, that you guys have either advocated for or been in the works on as far as legislation goes?
Yeah, so as a part of the human trafficking unit, that's kind of an interesting part of our unit is that we are able to really work with legislators and work on legislation. When I was a prosecutor, in the other units, I never got to talk about legislation. I never got to talk about, outreach opportunities or awareness events. But this human trafficking unit, because it's this centralized spot, we do work a lot on legislation. Our legislative partners, especially Representative Kim Williams, we are in constant contact with her about legislation that we think could strengthen our laws. I know within the last year, there was a bill and it was passed to make patronizing a prostitute if the person whom prostitution is sought is a minor, it enhances it to a felony. So, as I was saying before, patronizing a prostitute is a misdemeanor. We are still focused on it. We are still going to go after those sex buyers. But if somebody solicits somebody and they are a juvenile, then it will now be a felony.
Yeah, and the unit and its partners also work with victim advocates and local nonprofits to provide sex workers with victim services and other resources. Can you speak on these efforts further for sex workers who are being trafficked? What resources can they look to for support?
So there are resources throughout the state. There are different agencies that work with victims of human trafficking. Salvation Army is one of them that we work with a lot, that we bring in on operations to make sure that they're there, to make sure that there is a victim advocate present. We also work with the victim advocates within the police departments. So I know specifically to talk about one scenario, we worked with Dover Police Department and we brought in Salvation Army and the Dover Police victim advocates. And we were able to make contact with individuals that were prostituting in downtown Dover, able to make contact with them to say, how is everything going? What resources do you need? Do you need food? Do you need shelter? And really just be able to make those connections with them so they knew that there was someone in the community that could help them.
And looking towards the future, does the unit have any new approaches or operation efforts within the human trafficking realm? Obviously, as much as you can share, as related to these types of investigations, but anything DOJ wants to emphasize moving forward within human trafficking?
Sure. So we're just trying to bring a greater awareness about human trafficking. When I talk with people, they don't really have a sense of what exactly is human trafficking. A lot of people talk about Taken or The Sound of Freedom or things that they have seen on TV, but a lot of people don't think about how it's actually occurring here in Delaware. So just spreading greater awareness. A lot of what we do see is familial trafficking. So somebody being trafficked by a trusted loved one. And that's not what you see on TV. So the more we're able to talk about human trafficking and the more awareness we're able to spread, the greater it will be, the greater, awareness there will be. And I think we'll just continue to work on what we've been working on, trying to decrease the number of illicit massage establishments statewide and increase the number of reverse prostitution operations with law enforcement. Because our unit is statewide, we have the ability, to work in Sussex, Kent, and Newcastle. It's the same prosecutor, regardless of what county you're in. So being able to have that relationship and build off that relationship with law enforcement is important. So what we've been focusing on the last couple of years, we're going to continue to focus on.
Yeah, and this is directly related. I was just going to mention that, January was Human Trafficking Awareness Month. Did the unit or the department do anything unique during that month to better educate the public on this issue?
Sure. So obviously the press release came out in January, and that was helpful in educating the public on what exactly the Human Trafficking Unit has been working on recently. I also attended the Human Trafficking Proclamation and Resolution at Legislative Hall. So that was put forward by Representative Williams, and it was the first proclamation that the new governor has signed. I think it was 2 or 3 days after he had been sworn in. So that was a great event. It was attended by, law enforcement, victim service advocates, our legislative partners. So just continuing to get the awareness out there. I love that there is a Human Trafficking Awareness Month and that there is greater awareness during that month, but we want to keep that going all year round.
Definitely. And circling back just slightly, you mentioned that because Delaware is small enough, you're able to work with law enforcement across all three counties and it's the same prosecutor across all three counties. But is there anything about Delaware that makes human trafficking uniquely difficult or, creates any type of nuanced type of human trafficking that you notice that is kind of a Delaware specific issue? Or do you feel that largely because Delaware is small, it's simply just easier to at least, to some extent, crack down on these types of human trafficking units?
Sure. So because we are a small state, which I think is great, we are able to have that statewide response, but we are so close to other states. So a lot of times we work with our federal legislative partners or our federal partners and work with the U.S. Department of Justice because a lot of times cases do cross state lines. It may go into Ocean City, it may go into Pennsylvania, it may go into New Jersey. So we also have to have that strong connection with the U.S. Department of Justice as well, because when they are crossing state lines, then they're brought in.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political reporter Sarah Petrowich and Delaware Deputy Attorney General Caroline Brittingham for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. We head to the University of Delaware next to learn more about a U.S. soccer-funded program that could set new safety standards for heading worldwide. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Heading the ball is a fundamental soccer skill, and yet concerns about player safety have led to strict guidelines on when young athletes can begin practicing it. To make heading safer, University of Delaware Professor of Kinesiology and Applied Physiology Thomas Kaminsky is working to validate a U.S. soccer-funded training program that could set new global header safety standards. Delaware Public Media's Colin McKinnon spoke with Kaminsky this week about the program and how it helps players strengthen their bodies and reduce injury risks.
Let's start with some background on your Get Ahead Safely in Soccer program. This has been a longstanding issue in soccer, as in head and neck injuries that stem from heading the ball or the act of heading the ball, what happens when you're in flight and whatnot. Depending on the data you're looking at, roughly a third or fourth of all concussions in youth soccer happen during heading. So, Tom, is that why you originally decided to start the Get Ahead Safely in Soccer program to address these serious injuries that stem from heading the ball or what happens when you do head the ball?
In 2015, the United States Soccer Federation, aka US Soccer, was part of a class action lawsuit from some families in California. And it stemmed around the issue of concussion management. And so from that, they developed what is called the Recognize to Recover program by United States Soccer, US Soccer. And part of that program, or part of that outcome, if you will, was a new policy on heading the ball in United States youth soccer. That policy stated that if I am 10 years old or younger, I cannot head the ball in any practice or game situation. If I'm 11, I can begin to head the ball 11, 12, and 13, but I'm restricted to 20 to 30 headers per week in practice, unlimited in games. You know, word spread quickly. Coaches bought into it. The problem was that coaches at the ages of 11, when heading could begin, they were thirsty for somebody to give them some guidance on how to do this. And so, you know, I was in the right place at the right time. At that time, it was actually called the National Soccer Coaches Association, NSCA. And I got with them and we created this online diploma program for coaches who were part of the United Soccer Coaches to then be able to take this online diploma course. And it teaches coaches then how to effectively impart heading drills into their practice. And it's morphed from there. To be quite honest with you, Kyle, it's just started taking off.
Well, why are these heading related injuries happening then? You know, is obviously when you're heading the ball, there's various factors at play, and there is a random factor at play in terms of, you know, you could get elbowed in the head, whatnot. We spoke about this just now off air. You know, I guess what I'm asking, is this a youth development thing that where things aren't, you know, there's a disconnect, a coaching and heading, you know, guidance thing at young ages? What are your thoughts there in terms of the gap that you're filling and why that exists in the first place?
That's a good question. One of the things that our program, the Get Ahead Safely in Soccer program, does is it teaches kids to work on strengthening their neck and their core. And at that age, you know, there's a lot of motor development still going on. I mean, they're developing and they're, because as you know, as a player yourself, soccer heading is a learned skill. And so you got to have some repetitiveness to it. And you also have to have the strength component to it. And that repetitiveness is a learning component. So if you do it enough times, you get better at it. Our program allows coaches to impart just very simple strength training drills before practice, after practice, a couple days a week to help strengthen the neck and the core. So when they do go up in the act of heading, it's all one unit. And so the head, neck, and torso are going to act together as one versus kind of the bobblehead effect. The second interesting component of the Get Ahead Safely in Soccer program, too, is that coaches actually teach when athletes are in the air to protect their personal space. And that's with their arms out to kind of protect people from getting into that personal space and close to the head and neck region where, as you mentioned, you know, an errant elbow can come in, another player's head can come in. And if you are up in the air and you're protecting yourself from that, the chances of getting those concussions that you speak about are greatly lessened. And so that's what we're all about. The third component of our program is really teaching kids or allowing kids to practice the skill using lightweight balls.
So your Get Ahead soccer program, you've touched on a number of things already, but your Get Ahead Safely in Soccer program, it's funded by U.S. Soccer. It was already validated in female soccer players, and now you're testing the program in male youth soccer players this fall. And just so people know, Tom, if you get into a poor habit or get into a habit of poor heading technique at a young age, if you don't learn these core fundamentals, you know, and the same goes for other things in soccer and athletics. But if you get into a habit of poor heading techniques and whatnot at young ages, that's something that's hard to shake and can stick with you an entire playing career, right?
It sure is. It's quite simple. When we learn to do things, we program. We program our brain. We program our muscles so they have memory. When you do it enough times, it's pre-programmed. So when you pick up bad habits, we've got to try to erase that program and relearn. And that's hard, very difficult. And I see it all the time, especially in the high school level. Kids are out there and, you know, they're flying through the air and they're not protecting their personal space. They don't have very good strength and form. And they are the ones that are really prone to getting injury. And so the hope is that we can offer further validation of what we found with our girls study back in 2018, 2019. So we're real excited. I'll tell you, I can't thank the soccer community enough in the state of Delaware and certainly in the greater Wilmington, Delaware area. They've been extremely receptive to our participation and getting the players to buy into it, and parents too, as you know. A 12-year-old just can't consent. They have to have parental permission. So,
yeah, those parents, especially in youth sports and youth soccer. U.S. Soccer is also interested in requiring the program for coaches nationwide, at least down the line. Do we know what the next steps look like for that before it's a reality? I guess you kind of answered that question just now in validating it for men's. Is that the next step before it becomes more of a nationwide sort of deal?
Yeah, you know, Wilmington, Delaware is a small geographic area. And as you know, U.S. Soccer is, you know, throughout the United States. So I think the next logical step, Kyle, probably is some regional studies where we might pick some regions of the country and do the same thing to offer further validation. And then I think U.S. Soccer probably will buy into it to the point where they may say, you know what, it's a good program. We want all of our soccer affiliated programs, especially at the youth level, to be participating in this program. And I'm confident that it's probably going to work in that direction.
Sure seems like it. And I read that you believe research like this can drive policy worldwide. So as you know, for you being the only U.S. representative on the FIFA heading expert panel, what does that look like from your view? What kind of impact do you think something like this in the program and the data that comes out of it can potentially have on soccer on a large scale, and what heading looks like now and how it's coached and the technique that's instilled in youth players? You know, what about that and what it looks like in the future?
Yeah, another very good question. You know, the United States, whether we liked it or not, was on the forefront of this because, the Recognize to Recover program put out by the United States Soccer came about because of a lawsuit. And so we were really on the forefront of putting, you know, to light these guidelines for soccer heading at the youth level. No one had ever done that before. And so it was based on some knowledge of the folks at U.S. Soccer and their medical team. Very little evidence, but they had to start somewhere. And so they, you know, 10 and under probably shouldn't be heading the ball. That made sense. The rest of the world had to play catch up. And now you're just starting to see countries like England have adopted actually a more stringent policy because theirs is 12 years old. If you're 12 and younger, you can't have the ball. And so there are other countries that are starting to develop these guidelines for youth players. And I think that, you know, being on the forefront with the development of these guidelines to begin with, that bodes well for the United States. And hopefully, I think U.S. Soccer sees that because they then can use, you know, the rest of the world can use some of the data which we find from this. And being part of that FIFA group, the expert heading group, is huge because we're driving policy for the rest of the world. Not all countries have guidelines for youth soccer players. They're just starting to come on board. And so in the next 10 years, you're going to see an explosion. And why not? I mean, this is a very vulnerable population. We want to protect them at all costs. What will happen is, and this will be interesting to see, is the trickle down, the kind of the downstream effect. So let's say you cut off heading. In the United States, you can't, you're 10 years old and younger, you can't head the ball. Well, how does that play out when these kids are 18 and 19 and 20 and they're on the U.S. national team? Does it impact style of play? It very well could. You know, I start to see even college players, they're reluctant to head because a size 5 ball coming at that speed hurts. So they'll play it to their chest or they'll play it to their feet. And so it impacts style of play. And I think that downstream effects, you're going to start to see that countries that may have adopted these policies, the style of play is just a little bit different. The ball is not in the air that much. They play it to their feet. And in some countries, that's just how it is. You know, the style of play is different. But I do think it will be interesting to see how it all plays out into the future, you know, in terms of how much heading is actually going to take place in a soccer match. At the youth level, Kyle, very little. There are very few headers in U12 soccer, very few. You know, when you get to 14, 15, 16, they're a little older. They've matured a little bit more. The ball's in the air a little bit more, and headers start to increase. So you see this upward slope, if you will, very limited at U12, U13s. And then as 14, 15, 16, they advance. There's more headers. But still, it's not a large amount. And that's a good thing. You know, that's a good thing. We don't need to be hitting our head a lot in the sport of soccer.
Thanks to UD Professor of Kinesiology and Applied Physiology, Thomas Kaminsky, and our Kyle McKinnon for joining us on The Green this week. Up next, Arts Playlist, and a look at Goldie Beacom College Professor Scott Glenn's screenplay, Heroes for Heaven, selected for the 2025 Buford International Film Festival. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Goldie Beacom College in Pike Creek Valley is celebrating Assistant Professor of Business Scott Glenn's recent achievement in the world of film. Glenn earned a spot in the 2025 Buford International Film Festival in South Carolina with his screenplay, Heroes from Heaven, Battleground Earth. Glenn's screenplay, adapted from his 2016 book of the same title, explores a dystopian future where a disillusioned leader teams up with biblical heroes to overthrow an oppressive regime. The screenplay is one of only 5 selected from more than 500 submissions from around the globe. In this week's edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny catches up with Glenn for more on Heroes from Heaven.
Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got to this point.
Wow. Man, I teach entrepreneurship classes, so you can call me an accidental entrepreneur. I stumbled into this. I was actually doing a book signing in San Antonio, Texas. I did a book signing tour East Coast to West Coast. While I was in San Antonio, they were filming an actual film. And as I was signing books at the bookstore there, someone approached me and asked me, was I an actor? And I told them no, but I could be. And the rest was history. So her name was Stanzi Stokes. She's part of my team. She did the casting director for The Terminator, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventures, and a couple other movies. Very prominent. She's retired now, but she's the one that really motivated me. When the book came out, I told her, I said, I'm going to make this into a screenplay. She said, Scott, you can do it. And after a while, I started networking with different people, and I hooked up with a guy who knew how to do the format. And that's when it all started in terms of the screenplay. I submitted it right before the pandemic, 2018. Got a lot of interest in terms of investors. Won some awards out in Vegas International Film Festival, Christian Film Festival. Pandemic came, put everything to a halt. But I take negatives and make it a positive. It gave me time to explore through Zoom and different people. So I ran into a guy named Greg Schwabe, who's now on my team. He has projects as well. what the investors like to see. They want to see if their money can fold over. So I'm tied to his projects. And now that we have mine rolling again, along with his, he's very, very busy. My attorneys and all of our people got on the same page. I couldn't take a 6-month sabbatical, so I gave him the rights to the screenplay. He's a very trustworthy guy, so he's pitching it for me as well, along with our other projects.
Well, tell me what the book and the subsequent screenplay is about.
Actually, they're all different. The book is totally different. To make it suitable for the big screen, we had to condense that into like a 120 screenplay pages. So the first screenplay was very legit, but I had some other people involved. I wanted to add to it. The other person didn't. So I turned around and said, okay, that's fine. We won't use that screenplay. We'll start over again. So to make a long story short, we have a protagonist, antagonist, Lachen, and Matthias. The world's in turmoil. Each continent has an evil leader. Each represents the seven deadly sins, each one of those leaders, and the world's hanging in the balance. So it's very, it has biblical context, but it's also very exciting. The book is kind of a little violent, unlike the screenplay. So there's three different entities in terms of the book and the two screenplays. The last screenplay, which got nominated for Beaufort, that's what we're going to go to in 2 weeks in terms of the award ceremonies.
So, where and how and when can people see your writing on the big screen?
The way I'm looking at it, I would say, this is something that you really can't time because we have other projects as well. I'm trying to maybe within the next year or so, year and a half, once we get the funding that we want. And the key is the funding for all the projects, which we're doing pretty good. So I'd like to say within the next year and a half, maybe.
I wonder, we're talking about a novel and a pair of screenplays, a really detailed universe that you've created. What was the inspiration to create this story?
Well, around 2012, 2013, I was looking at the aspects of different parts of our country and the world and where we were going. And being a biblical person, I read, if you read 2 Timothy chapter 3, it talks about the end days. So I looked at that chapter, 2 Timothy chapter 3, and I looked and just imagine how the world back in 2012, 2013, and here we are in 2025, we're not too far off. And just wondered what it would be like in decades to come if we don't continue to understand what morals, values, and ethics are. And to be honest with you, since I had that notion, it looks like we're headed that way in some facet, but we'll see.
You touched on this a little bit before, but I'd like to delve a little bit deeper. The process of going from a novel to a screenplay, how does that work for you? What were the challenges of turning your novel into something for the screen?
Actually, if you know people, they sat down and we talked. I mean, it took hours showing me the format, putting things together, making sure. Now, the book is more detailed, where in a screenplay, you can't be as detailed. So you have to have the right verbiage, the right words to make sure that you keep the story intact as well. Was it really hard? Not really, just time consuming, but it was actually fun. So as we were putting the book to the screenplay, we made some changes and some adaptations and actually made it better.
What does it mean to you professionally, but also as a writer, as a creative person, to have this screenplay in the festival in South Carolina?
Being an entrepreneur and having vision, a lot of people can see, but only a few people have vision. And when you do, not too many people see your vision or understand it until it's successful. I knew it was special when it first came out because of the interest that was involved. I had some big wigs out in Hollywood. I'm not going to say the studio, but they wanted the 100% rights, and I would not turn it over. No matter what, I'm always going to maintain the rights. When you have something special, people will come, they'll accept it. You just have to be patient, and it's all about timing. The pandemic came, which was a disaster, but like I said, it enabled me to pick up some more people on my team. So it's a growing process, and I think we're right on target right now.
I've been struck by how you keep talking about this being a team effort, not a solo endeavor. and how you share the credit with your team. Can you talk a little bit about the team that you've got working with you?
Well, one thing, you know, I teach you some entrepreneurship business classes. Your team will grow. Some people will leave. Some people will come. Trust factor is very important. People have to be on the same page. My team is very diverse. Not the diversity of your black, white, gay, straight, diverse mind thinking, different aspects of the to make the screenplay successful. And at the same time, you know, having T-shirts and hoodies and all the marketing tools that go along with it. Social media, the website, everyone has to be on the same page, all in.
You've spoken at length about the entrepreneurship side of this, and I wonder, what's your advice to somebody who's got an idea and wants to turn that idea into a book or wants to turn it into a screenplay? What's your advice for somebody who aspires to get to where you are?
Exploitation and exploration. Sometimes you start off one-sided and you stumble into something else. If you have a vision, stay focused on that vision, acquire a nice team, and understand that it takes time. You have to have patience, tough skin. I've been shot down, but at the same time, once you started winning awards, some of the people that said no started to come back. So what I would say is make sure you have a sound team of knowledgeable people. Keep your vision, have tough skin, and you have to market yourself as well as the screenplay or the book in the right way on a regular basis with the right people.
And what's next for both the screenplay and for you?
I'm going to go down to Buford. There's some, do some networking. I'm meeting some people down there. One of my executive producers is going to come down, and I want to win some more contests. Right now, I won one in California, one in Vegas, now one Southeast. I want to win one up North and then Southwest and maybe two international. So I'm going to pile this up, keep getting our funding with our other projects. And when it's time to hit and run with it, we're going to run.
Thanks to Goldie Beacom College Assistant Professor of Business, Scott Glenn, and R. Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. And we finish out the green next with History Matters, where we explore how the chaos of the American Revolution opened unexpected paths to freedom for enslaved African Americans. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. The American Revolution is often remembered as a war for liberty, but for African Americans, it was a fight with even higher stakes. Many saw the war as an opportunity to claim their own independence, some by serving in the ranks, others by seizing newfound chances to escape enslavement. On February 20th, historian and author Richard Bell visits the Delaware History Museum in Wilmington to speak about how the chaos of the American Revolution created unexpected paths to freedom for many enslaved people. And in this edition of History Matters, Delaware Public Media's Joey Rosari is joined by Bell to explore this pivotal chapter in Black history.
When most people hear that the American Revolution was a transformative event in African American history, I think they're probably surprised to hear that and would think you meant to say the Civil War and not the American Revolution. So can you unpack that for us and why the American Revolution was such a significant moment for African Americans?
Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong, of course, with thinking of the Civil War as a transformative moment in African American history, which it certainly was. But it's also true that the American Revolution, a series of events we don't often reflexively connect with African American history, is also a watershed moment for people of African descent in the country that's about to become the United States. And that's because in any major war, enslaved populations seek to make the best opportunity they can of the disruptions caused by a war. So in the case of the American Revolution, you see enslaved people seize the opportunity to try to claim freedom for themselves by escaping from their enslavers on both sides of the line and headed for whatever army they think is most likely to offer them sanctuary in return for their military intelligence, geopolitical intelligence, labor, manpower, etc. That's true in the Civil War, famously, but it's also true in the American Revolution, which I think many scholars would argue is a freedom war for African Americans.
And this might seem obvious to some, but do we have an idea of how enslaved individuals broadly viewed the war?
enslaved individuals' perceptions of the ideologies and causes that both sides are fighting for is hard to recover with the surviving historical sources that we have because of limits on enslaved people's literacy at the time, the relatively small number of free black folks of African descent at this point in American history, and of course, the lack of care to preserve what records enslaved and free black people who were literate actually produced. So there's a lot of inference involved. And the most useful way to do that is, of course, to look at behavior, to see what enslaved people did. And we know that many of them seized the opportunity to run away and to join actually the British army, which is perhaps counterintuitive given what we normally think about the Patriots' slogans about liberty and equality. But there's a reason for that, and that's because several commanders of British forces in North America announce what you could think of as freedom proclamations or miniature emancipation proclamations, where they promise enslaved individuals who are owned by Patriot enslavers that if they abandon their Patriot enslavers and come find British lines and come join the British Army, that they will be rewarded for that move with lifelong freedom after Britain wins the war. And so that's an unprecedented offer. And so we know that tens of thousands of enslaved people surged towards British lines to try and force British commanders to make good on those promises.
So what were some of the biggest or most impactful contributions that African Americans made to the Revolutionary War effort?
We can see African Americans making important contributions on both sides of the political divide. And I certainly don't want to give anyone the impression that enslaved people only fought on the British side. That's not true. The rough numbers we have suggest that approximately 5,000 to 6,000 black people, many of them enslaved at the start of the war, come into the Patriot lines by one means or another and serve in various military skirmishes. I'm thinking of the Battle of Bunker Hill, for instance, up in Boston as one example. They also serve sometimes in Patriot privateers, which means, you know, a maritime service at sea. And so their military contributions, whether it's at land and on sea, are always to augment the fighting strength of whatever side they've joined. But numbers-wise, we know that there's really no comparison. Numbers-wise, we know that somewhere between 25,000 and 30,000 black people, most of them formerly enslaved, choose the king's side in hopes of holding those British commanders to promises of lifelong freedom they've made, and that their augmentation of both troop strength that battles like the battles of Great Bridge in Norfolk, Virginia, and their efforts to strengthen civilian supply chains, to work in British Navy yards in places like New York and Brooklyn, to be laborers, to be drivers, to be cooks, to be stable masters, all indirectly augments the British war effort as well. Both of these sides, Joe, are trying to build complex coalitions of manpower and sometimes woman power to throw at the enemy. And African Americans make, I think, decisive contributions on both sides of the line.
I'm sure there are going to be a lot of listeners out there who'll be surprised to hear that African Americans threw themselves into the Revolutionary War effort with more enthusiasm and with more at stake than many white colonists. But how did African Americans' participation in the war challenge prevailing notions of race and freedom in colonial America?
Yes, that's such an important question, because we know that several thousand enslaved people at the start of the war do in fact gain their freedom as a result of their military service. By the end of the war, they hold those British commanders to their promises. They hold a few patriots to similar promises in smaller numbers. But we also know that their participation really shines a spotlight on the flimsiness of all the sloganeering among white colonists about liberty and equality. There's a British commentator living in London at the time. His name's Dr. Johnson, Dr. Samuel Johnson. He's famous to Americans as the writer of the English Dictionary. And he's a staunch supporter of the King's cause. And when he's commenting on the white patriot colonists' sloganeering, he says, "How is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the owners of enslaved people?" I'm paraphrasing a little bit there. So he's pointing out what many British people at the time, and certainly what many enslaved African Americans at the time, regarded as the dissonance between white colonists' claims to be fighting for liberty and equality and the fact that some of those white patriots, of course, simultaneously owned enslaved people at the same time, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, being famous examples. So African-American participation in the war, especially against the Patriots, sort of reminds us that this was a very active debate about what freedom means, what liberty means, what equality means, and for whom, Joe, in the 1770s and 1780s.
So your upcoming talk on February 20th at 6:30 p.m. at the Delaware History Museum is titled "To Preserve Slavery, Human Bondage and the American Revolution," and it's made possible in part by a grant from Delaware 250. So as we reflect on African Americans' invaluable place in the revolution, how can we better recognize the history and agency of African Americans during the revolution, both in historical scholarship and in public knowledge?
What I can say, Joe, in response to that very challenging question is that the work is being done by scholars, many of them scholars of color, of course, to shine a spotlight on the contributions of African-American people at every point in America's long history, including the Revolution, not simply the Civil War. And so I'd encourage anyone who wants to learn more to come out to the talk, to contact me if they want to get a list of reading to keep them busy for a whole summer on these topics, or to read any of the recent book-length accounts of the American Revolution written by reputable scholars that incorporate this important strand into their narrative of how this war unfolded. I'm thinking, for instance, of a recent book by Woody Holton, who teaches at the University of South Carolina, who wrote a fantastic one-volume history of the American Revolution about 2 years ago. That book by Professor Holton is called Liberty is Sweet, and it incorporates a very broad cast of characters into that familiar narrative about the American Revolution. So we get all the usual redcoats, we get all our patriot heroes that we know and love, but we also get a much richer cast supplemented by lots and lots of women on both sides, by Native American figures, and of course by African-American enslaved people and free people, each fighting to advance their own agendas in time of war. And that multicultural reality, I think, is a reality at every point in American history. And we are never served by sanding away that complexity or boiling complicated, multifaceted stories down to simple heroes and villains, rebels and redcoats. American history is always messier than that, Joe, and always, I think, a lot more interesting.
Thanks to historian and author Richard Bell and our Joe Irizarry for showing us why history matters this week. And we've reached the finish line for this episode of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Joe Irizarry, Martin Matheny, and Sarah Petrowich, along with our senior producer, Kyle McKinnon. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.